Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Vayechi. This week, Rabbi Meir Schweiger discusses Vayechi. Rabbi Meir Schweiger is a senior faculty member at Pardes and serves as the Pardes Mashkiach Ruchani, the spiritual guide for Pardes. And now, Rabbi Meir Schweiger.
Thank you, Larry. This week's parsha is Parshat Vayechi. The focus of the parsha is the death and the burial of Jacob. And as we've noted in a previous podcast, it is very ironic that a parsha which focuses on death should be referred to as Vayechi, and he lived. And we have a parallel parsha, which is in the book of Bereishit, Chayei Sarah, which also speaks about the death and burial of Sarah. How do we understand this phenomenon? One approach is to say, as the rabbis do in a number of places, righteous people, even in their death, remain alive. This comment is related to a concept of the immortality of the soul, of a life after death. Death brings about the dissolution of the body, of that concrete element of our existence. But the soul continues on. Righteous people continue to live forever in the world of souls. Another way of understanding this is that righteous people continue to live by virtue of the legacy which they hand down to future generations. I would like to focus on this element in examining this week's parsha. There is a very interesting rabbinic comment based on a verse in our parsha. This is in chapter 48, verse number 1, where it says, after these words, events, and he said to Joseph, behold, your father is ill. And the rabbis note, this is the first time in the Chumash, in the Bible, where we are told that someone is ill. This is the first time where illness precedes one's death. And on that basis, the rabbis say, this is from the Talmud, Tractate Baba Metzia, page 87a. Until the time of Jacob, there was never a concept of illness. Jacob came along and prayed that there should be illness. And I will add, perhaps, illness preceding one's death. And so he is the first example of someone who is sick before they die. As Rabbi Levi Cooper noted in another podcast, once upon a time the way people died was they would sneeze and their soul would simply expire, depart through their nostrils. In the same way that God breathes into us the breath of life, God removed that breath of life through the act of sneezing. It would seem to us that this would be a preferred way to die. Painless, aesthetic. Why would Jacob ask to be ill? And Rashi in the Talmud says that Jacob wants to have a sign, a signal, before he dies, so that he will be able to gather his sons, to be able to give them his parting words, and I will add, to be able to basically create a closure to his life. There is a very famous halachic work called Gesher HaChayim. It was written by a Jerusalem rabbi, Rabbi Michal Tukuchinsky, who lived in the late 1800s, first half of the 1900s. As I said, this is a major halachic work. But there is one section which is philosophic, where he goes into a whole discussion of what in fact is life and hence what is death. And I would like to just take one point which he brings up, which is our lives are a book which we write. This is based on Genesis chapter 5 verse 1, where it says, this is the book of the generations of man. And although the simple reading of the text there is that it is now giving us the history of humanity, the book is the genealogy of humanity. But he maintains that what is true on the macro level is also true on the micro level. Our lives are a book. The days of our lives are chapters in that book. And each of us has to ask the question, what book are we writing? What book will we leave to our children and future generations? To what degree are we consciously living our lives? And to what degree does our death become the culmination, the conclusion of everything that we've lived for? Jacob's greatness is reflected in this week's parsha, in his death. In the act of dying, Jacob brings together all the loose ends of his life, finishes his book, and hands it over to the next generation. Let us see how this unfolds in our parsha. Let's begin with the opening line. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt for 17 years, and all the days of Jacob, the years of his life, were 147 years. In theory, the Torah could have used a different word for Jacob being in the land of Egypt. It could have simply said, and Jacob was, Vayehi, in the land of Egypt. It could have said, and he settled, Vayeshev be'eretz Mitzrayim. It could have said, Vayagor, he dwelled in the land of Egypt. But it chose to use the word, he lived. And it's not coincidental. My sense is that the simple meaning of the text is that Jacob came to life in those last 17 years of his life. When we look at Jacob's reaction when Joseph disappeared, when Jacob thinks that Joseph was prematurely killed, Jacob is in mourning, in tears, refuses to be consoled. And when the brothers come back to him in last week's parsha, and they tell him that Joseph is still alive, Jacob's response, this is the last verse in chapter 45:28. Actually, I'm sorry, it's the next to last, 27. It says, Vatechi Ruach Yaakov Avihem. And the spirit of Jacob comes to life. Jacob coming to the land of Egypt is a new lease on life. First of all, he is provided for during a time of famine. But much more significantly, it is not that physically his life is taken care of. It's that he is reunited with his son. There is a reunification of the family. Jacob's spirit is once again revitalized. Interestingly, coming back to our parsha in the second verse, it says, and the days of Israel were approaching, the days of his death. How exactly did he know he was about to die is unclear. And I will even add, to me, it is very unclear. But somehow he has a sense he may very well be going soon. And as I mentioned earlier, it is very important for him to orchestrate his death, to pull together all the loose ends. What is the first thing that he does? He calls for his son Joseph, and he asks, commands, do not bury me in the land of Egypt. With the flip side being, this is in verse 30, chapter 47, verse 30, do not bury me in the land of Egypt. Rather, I will lie with my fathers. You will take me up from Egypt. Bury me in their burial places. Not only does Jacob ask this of Joseph, he makes him take an oath to that effect. And Joseph does so. Why is Jacob so insistent that he should not be buried in the land of Egypt? Rashi, based on Midrash, gives three explanations. One explanation is that Jacob knows that in the future there will be the 10 plagues. One of the 10 plagues is lice. Lice which come forth from the ground. Jacob asked Joseph to not bury him in Egypt, because when that will happen, he does not want the lice swarming, creeping all over his body. A second explanation which Rashi offers. Jacob knows, believes, that one day there will be resurrection of the dead. And according to rabbinic tradition, those who are resurrected must be resurrected in the land of Israel. If one is buried in the land of Israel, then they simply come out of the ground, back to life. But those who are buried outside the land of Israel need to somehow be transported to the land of Israel. And so the rabbis say there are these subterranean tunnels through which the bodies will roll until they come to the land of Israel, at which point they will sprout forth from the ground and be resurrected. And so Jacob does not want to experience the rolling sensation when the resurrection will come. These two explanations certainly strike me as being a little bit far-fetched. The idea that Jacob is concerned about what will happen to his body with the lice, or what will happen when the resurrection comes in terms of the rolling, somehow this does not satisfy me. There's a third explanation, which has much more appeal. The third explanation says that Jacob is afraid that after he dies, he will become an icon in Egypt. He will be worshipped. And in fact, we know that the Egyptian kings were embalmed and that there was a worship of the dead. And therefore, Jacob is concerned that in his death, he should not become the object of worship. He should not become an idol. He should not become the stumbling block for future generations. But I would like to suggest another possibility, which is not in Rashi, which I think is a closer reading of the text. And that is, Jacob does not want to be buried in Egypt because he is afraid that if he is buried in Egypt, this will mark the end of the Jewish people. And let me explain what I mean by that. The last verse in last week's parsha, which describes the state of Jacob's family after they have come down to Egypt, chapter 47, verse 27. And Israel settled in the land of Egypt, in the land of Goshen, and they were grabbed by it. Vayeachazuva. And they flourished and multiplied in it. When Jacob originally came to the land of Egypt, his mindset, and what should have been the mindset of his children, was that we have come to dwell in this land, lagur ba'aretz, to dwell temporarily. This is a place where we need to be as a stopgap during a time of famine, with the idea being, eventually, we will go back to the land of Israel. But what has happened to Jacob's family, and how long did this take? Very unclear. It would seem to be that it happened in a relatively short period of time. Is that they became entrenched in Egypt. They settled there. They flourished there. But even worse, vayeachazuva. They were grabbed by this place. The word achuza means this is the place where their roots are. This is the place where they will remain forever. Jacob, or perhaps I should now say Israel, in that capacity of being Israel, is very concerned about what is happening to his children. He is very concerned that if he will be buried in Egypt, this may be the final blow which will strike roots in Egypt and cut his children off from the land of Israel. And therefore Jacob says, do not bury me in Egypt, but rather I want to go to my forefathers, to be buried in their burial plot. By being buried in the land of Israel, Jacob is signaling to his children, your place is in the land of Israel. And if I now go back to Parshat Chaye Sarah, there are many parallels between these two stories. The burial of Sarah and the burial of Jacob. In the burial of Sarah, Abraham is not just negotiating for a burial plot. He wants what's called an achuzat kever, a burial plot which will be his forever, which will stake out his claim to the land of Israel. And Jacob, being fully aware of that, is signaling to his children, your achuzah is not the land of Egypt. Your achuzah is the land of Israel. By insisting on being buried in the land of Israel, he is indicating to his children that ultimately the land of Israel is where they need to establish themselves. And even if it will not happen immediately, they must realize the land of Egypt is not their achuzah. Initially, Jacob gives this directive to Joseph. But the very last thing which he does before he dies, this is in chapter 49, verse 29. Jacob, when he has all of his children around him, commands them, says to them, I am about to be gathered unto my people. Bury me unto my forefathers in the cave which is in the field of Ephron the Hittite. And then he goes into a long description. The cave which is in the Machpelah, in the field of Machpelah, in Mamre, in the land of Canaan, which Abraham purchased, La'achuzat Kaver, verse 30. There was Abraham and Sarah buried. That is where Isaac and Rebekah were buried, and that is where I buried Leah. That is the last thing which he tells his sons. And in verse 33, we're told, when he finishes commanding his sons, he gathers together his feet, he expires, and is gathered unto his people. By Jacob insisting on being buried in the land of Israel, he is guaranteeing the future of his children. Note the fact that in the end of this week's parsha, we have a second death. That is the death of Joseph. And Joseph learned the lesson from his father. In chapter 50, verse 24, Joseph says to his brothers, I am about to die, and God will remember you and bring you out of this land to the land that he has sworn to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And then Joseph administers an oath to his brothers, saying, when God will remember you, be sure to bring up my bones from this place. This oath of Joseph was honored when the Jewish people left the land of Egypt. And in fact, we find, as the Jewish people are leaving Egypt in the beginning of Parshat Bishalach, in the book of Exodus, that it emphasizes that they took the bones of Joseph with them. Note the fact that Joseph links his being buried with God remembering them and bringing them back to the land of Israel, so that it is not only a question of being buried in the land of Israel, it is a question of the Jewish people coming back to the land of Israel, living in the land of Israel, actualizing their destiny in the land of Israel. That is the first thing which Jacob does. The second thing which Jacob does is to bless his grandchildren, Ephraim and Manasseh, as he is approaching his death. As I mentioned earlier, in the beginning of chapter 48, Joseph brings his two sons to Jacob, and Jacob perks up, and then Jacob blesses them. And the blessing which he gives them, Ephraim and Manasseh, as Reuven and Shimon, will be to me. In addition to that, he also says in chapter 48, verse 20, may Israel bless themselves in you and say, May God make you like Ephraim and Manasseh. Rabbi Soloveitchik has a very interesting article which speaks about Jacob being the first grandfather. And of course we know that that's not true, or the first Jewish grandfather, because in fact the first Jewish grandfather is Abraham. But what makes Jacob the first Jewish grandfather? It's the fact that he's the first one that we see who has a relationship with his grandchildren, who blesses his grandchildren. And perhaps this is also very significant in the context. Not only does Jacob bring together his children, as we will discuss in a few moments, but he also has a relationship with the next generation. And not only that, but he incorporates the next generation into his more limited circle. Ephraim and Manasseh will be like Reuven and Shimon. The practical ramification of this is that they are to be numbered among the 12 tribes. Joseph receives a double portion. Here again we have a situation where the younger brother is favored over the older brother. Manasseh is the firstborn, but Ephraim is mentioned first. The fact that the younger one is favored over the older one is not a source of discord, but in fact can happen in harmony. Which leads me to the next thing. Jacob's crowning achievement is the family that he built. When he dies, all of his children remain part of the family. When he eventually blesses them, even though the blessing of Reuven and Shimon and Levi does not sound particularly flattering, positive, yet nevertheless, they are blessed among the other brothers. They too are part of the Jewish people. Jacob's success was his ability to forge his children to ultimately become the Jewish people. When he blesses them, he is able to pick up on the qualities of each one of them, and through that to be able to see what their place will be among the people. Each one of them has a place, and he somehow is conveying to them how they complement each other. Reuven, who is very impulsive, cannot be a leader, yet nevertheless, he can still play a role among the people. Shimon and Levi, who are zealots, can also not be leaders, yet nevertheless, their zealotry can be what charges the people in a positive way, in a very constructive way. When Jacob dies, he truly closes out his life. In a previous podcast, I mentioned that Jacob's life work, which happened in the diaspora, was to build a family. He began that process in the house of Laban. He completed that process in the land of Egypt when he brought them all together and gave them his final blessings. As I mentioned earlier, each one of us writes a book. Each one of us has something very unique to contribute. I think sometimes it is the rare individual who perhaps has a sense of what is really unique about them, what is their book, and knows how to pursue that and ultimately put the finishing touches on so that when their time comes, they can truly say that they have finished their book. None of us know when that time will come. Yet nevertheless, we all have the ability to pursue and to discover what is our book. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you, Rabbi Schweiger. Your comments on the podcast are always appreciated, so please send an email to podcasts@pardesusa.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you in the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.